So if I have to quote on the Tanya, I'll quote. It's not a problem. But I just want to know. Okay. Gentlemen, let us roll. Okay, you have that position, everything position that's over there. Fine. Today is January 17th, 2011. It's Monday morning. And did you give it back to me? Here it is. Okay, thank you. I just don't want to mix it up with the other material. Fine. Last week, you see, so we saw the conservative movement through from 1887 through 2011. And then we raised the whole issue, how do you deal with people who are non-observant? And I don't have to tell you, this issue haunts us. Because on one hand, you have the psak of 11 Rashi Yeshiva, that you're not allowed to have a joint rabbinical board, you're not allowed to have a synagogue council. And I understand that. It's not that I want to say that I differ. It's not that I differ. I understand it because the minute you get involved in pluralism, the minute you sit with Reform and conservative rabbis, the message you're leaving is that everyone is equal. And Yitzchak, relax yourself. The message you leave is that everyone is equal and that you have your choice. I agree with Yitzchak that what I'm saying is not universal. It depends on the circumstances, where you are and under what circumstances. And all of you can ask Rabbi Abi Schneider, who teaches in Torah Tshraka, that I once paskened for him to go speak in a Reform temple. But it depends what the circumstances are. On the other hand, with all our desire to make clear that pluralism is not Torah, and Torah means acceptance and surrender, we want to keep the channels of communication open. And it's very important to understand Jews were not observant. There is no one who has a din of apikoros b'sman hazeh. That is the Rambam. I showed you the Rambam in Hilchot Mamrim. I showed you the Chazon Ish. I showed you that magnificent letter of Rav Kook, which, again, you know, Bizman Hazer, Rabbi Revel already had the question, if someone intermarries, do you sit Shiva? And, you know, the basic approach was, what's to be accomplished? Chayrim is only good when the community as a whole is observant, and they take the person who's a sinner and put him in Chayrim. But if the community as a whole is not observant, what good does Chayrim accomplish? The same thing with sitting Shiva. Sitting Shiva for someone who marries a non-Jew is, in contemporary times, will accomplish next to nothing. And I know cases, Lo Aleinu, I know a very important rabbi whose daughter married a non-Jew, and he sat Shiva. Did he accomplish anything? I have my doubts. The person that we're talking about, the lady, never came back to Yiddishkeit. Ultimately, she divorced that husband. I don't know if she married again, but it's a sad story. And this is the Chazon Ish, this is the Rambam, this is Rav Kook. Children today who are led away by alien ideologies, we have to keep the channel of communication open. Allah atama v'kama to the Jews across the length and breadth of the world, who today are four, five, six generations removed from the last forebears who observed Torah, who knew what Torah is about, who studied Torah, and all that's implied by what I just said. Now, and on a practical level, you all know that you take the NCSY, for instance. In earlier times, it was Torah Leadership Seminar that preceded the NCSY, if I'm correct, or they're about the same time. But the NCSY went out today. As far as I know, TLS does not exist, and NCSY is a major, major international movement. You take B'nai Akiva in my time, Shomer Hadati before my time, and all these organizations reached out to youngsters who came from homes that were not religious. So you see, you have to keep channels of communication open. Now, what's very important is to understand a non-religious Jew. And here I want to share with you a document that is second to none. And I want to make a point in advance so you understand. We religious Jews have a concept that the Western world is practically totally lacking. And that concept is, there's a higher authority, there's a set of laws. We are not free individuals. A kid growing up in the Western world rejoices. Why? He's free. It's not communist China. It's not, when we were growing up, not communist Russia. You can do whatever you want. And a kid growing up in the Western world has total free choice. And this is the New York Times today. This is Western society. This is Washington, D.C. This is why people are not married. Everything we spoke about yesterday that came into the tshuva and the pilegesh. There's no concept. In other words, in the Western world, as long as I don't harm somebody else, I can do whatever I want. As long as I don't bring shmuel, as long as I don't break your windows, I can do whatever I want. And that is labriyot, a beautiful Western concept, and I'm not here to challenge it, but it's different than Torah. Torah's concept is that even a child is going to be taught, you can't eat this, you have to wait between meat and milk, you have to look and see if it's kosher. And you all know, if you raise children in Israel, perhaps it doesn't apply as much, but certainly chutz laretz, a kid already at an early age, mom, dad, Abba, Ima, is this kosher? Can we eat it? Is there an OU? Is there a Heksha? Shabbos, I told you, Muktzah. And a kid already from the age of two on is inculcated with a feeling that he has to question. He's limited. He can't do whatever he wants. Now, the average Jew who's not religious, and it's not that he's in rebellion. He knows nothing. And he takes for granted he's Western. Why should he be limited? Why should he have to abstain from something? And it's more than that. Their whole concept of Judaism, and Richard Joel coined the phrase when he was the head of the Hillel House, Hillel, National Hillel, whatever. So Richard Joel coined the phrase, do something Jewish. And do something Jewish. And all right, the Lubavitcher Rebbe also said that you medavtan epis Yiddish. You know, you should do something, feel that you're a Jew. And that phrase is very interesting. But what does it mean, do something Jewish? For the sake of argument, a person who's totally treif will make a Hanukkah party that's kosher. But you see, he's not making it with a halakhic concept. At the end of the Hanukkah party, which is kosher, he'll go back to eating treif, and he'll see nothing wrong with it. And that's his mindset. And he'll view, you understand, eating kosher, going to shul, or going to a temple, he's doing a Jewish act. Tut epis Yiddish. All right, now Richard Joel could not say, surrender to the halacha, you understand? When we preach sermons, we have to preach, surrender to the halacha. But Richard Joel, in his position as national head of Hillel, could not talk that way. But do something Jewish. Okay, now, I want to quote from a Lubavitch publication, and this is an early issue. It's a fabulous publication that comes out until today. Ba'ar HaTorah. Are any of you familiar with Ba'ar HaTorah? I'm quoting from number 6, 1987. And this publication, Ba'ar HaTorah, over the decades, has specialized in not just Torah and Hasidus, but also a lot of scientists have been involved in publication.
Not Branover.
In articles. I don't know if Branover founded Ba'ar HaTorah, but Branover, over the years, I believe I've seen articles by Branover and by his children as well. Anyway, this is an article by one of the most famous Balei Tshuva in the Chabad world, Professor Velvel Green. You've heard the name. He was a rocket scientist, a space scientist. And Velvel Green.
That was not his real name.
Velvel?
He was a rocket scientist. His name was something else.
Let's see if I got the name. It could be his name. One second, let's see here if they give a different name. No, it's also Velvel Green. But I don't know. I don't know whether you have here the original name. But beside that, could be. Your name is not Yitz either. It's Irwin. So he had a name which you can imagine. Velvel, maybe it was Kenny. I don't know. Figure it out. Now, I'm quoting from Be'er HaTorah 1987, and this article is so revealing. Now, Velvel was raised in Canada, and he was raised in a Yiddish home, a home that had Jewish feeling, but no religion whatsoever. He went to a folk shula. Again, this doesn't exist today. I still remember in the Bronx, you had a scattering of a few shuls, a few schools, I should
kindering,
say. The kindering, it was socialist.
Work
they were
circle,
the workman
circle.
Workman circle.
They still have a couple.
Yeah,
the
Yiddishists. The Yiddishists, they learn, they read Peretz, they read the Shalom Aleichem.
Used to give a talk there.
Yeah, yeah, I understand. I understand. Yeah. Now, what's also interesting about this article is the shliach of Chabad that they meet, Rabbi Moshe Feller, and the way this shliach works. And you see, these are real halachic problems. For the sake of argument, you meet someone who's a machal Shabbos ochlin velit and treif, but you're under rabbinate. You're gonna. At a certain point, I plead guilty to this. At a certain point, you're going to try to tell him off in a nice way. You're going to preach a sermon, and he's there, and you want to hit hard. And all right, sometimes you have results. Sometimes all you do is push him away. Chabad, and I've seen this time and again, they don't preach, they don't say a word, they're friendly, they accept, and they never rebuke you, and you can eat treif, and you're driving on Shabbos. And yet somehow, over the years, the example you see in front of you has an effect on you. Now, and this Velvel Green is married to a girl named Gail. Gail is very important in this story, as any story of every male. Without the woman, we're in real trouble. And Gail comes from a Reform background, so she even knows less than the professor. He, at least, came from a Yiddishist background. So he had some identity with Judaism, with Yiddish, with famous writers. She comes from a totally Reformed background. And even before we met Rabbi Moshe Feller in 1962, we would have been considered active and even committed Jews. Most of our friends were Jewish. Our families were Jewish. Our interests included Jewish things. You hear Jewish things, that's exactly an echo of President Joe when he was with Hillel House. And our outlook was certainly Jewish. Listen to this description. He is so insightful. We read books published by the Jewish Publication Society. We listened to Jewish records. We treasured the Chagall prints in our home. And were dues paying members of a conservative synagogue. Gail was a leading soprano in the synagogue choir, and I was one of the very few members who attended on most Friday nights, regardless of whether bat mitzvah were being celebrated that weekend. And you know what I'm talking about. This is what the professor Simon Greenberg told me, the vice chancellor of the seminary, that our greatest tragedy is that even with the head to the drive the temple on Shabbat, it's still empty unless there's a bar mitzvah. So, but you see, before we met Rabbi Feller, however, I don't remember doing anything deliberately, or for that matter, abstaining from anything deliberately, because and only because it was a Torah commitment. Such thoughts never really entered my mind. That's exactly my point. The concept of halacha, they don't have whatsoever. One went to a synagogue, lit candles, ate gefilte fish, wore a talit. Not because it was, I'll put it in simple English, the proper thing to do. But it had nothing to do with halacha. You go to shul, you put on a talit. You have a meal on Shabbat, you eat gefilte fish. On the other hand, we didn't keep kosher or refrain from driving on the Sabbath or any of those other things. They were simply not relevant. They played no role in my value system. And this is so important, and he goes on and on. It's not that they were protesting. It's not that they were rebelling. It's a non-starter. It had no meaning, no understanding. It's not their Judaism, man. You read a book, you hear a record, you go to the conservative temple. And yeah, there were a few Jews in town who were Shomer Shabbos. Very few. There were remarkably few of them in our town. And these were their traditions, their choices. We didn't think they were wrong, only slightly behind on the social evolution scale. I mean, that is, he's so insightful. And this is exactly the mentality. The average Jew, those of you that are Balei Tshuva, how do your relatives look at you? They don't look at you that you're any better or you're a more observant Jew. All right, you choose. We haven't made that choice. And in a certain way, they view you perhaps a bit primitive. That's the key word. Backwards. Social evolution. Moving back in space. I mean, and these are not bad people. I want you to understand, these are not bad people. It's just they were not exposed to Torah. And you got to understand, where would we be if not for our exposure? If not for the grace of God, there go I. Understand? Excuse me? No, I mean, his father and I and Yitz all can say the same thing. If not for the Shanghai crowd, where would we be?
What do you mean? If my mother would have given in to the neighbors and sent me to public school,
right.
It costs money to go to my mind.
Right, it costs money to go to mine, costs money to go to
the books.
Right.
Say that.
You're absolutely right.
There
for the grace of God, go I. And all of us. And you have to understand these people. You can never get angry at them. You can never get frustrated. You have to understand them. Sometimes you can spark them. Sometimes people already are 40, 50 years of age and they can't be reached. They're so set in their ways. But sometimes you can spark them. Now, he goes on, and we would have lived like this all our lives, except we met Rabbi Feller. And he tells the story how Rabbi Feller comes to his community and he wants to organize, you know, the way Chabatnikim, Chabat today, you should know, is a trademark in Florida,
a logo
in Hollywood, Florida. And how big is Hollywood, Florida? But for whatever the reasons are, it's a magnet. It's a magnet for frum Jews. So in a little area, you have a tremendous young Israel with 600 families. I was there, S.I.R. Rabbi Lookstein goes.
The signatures of.
What? No, that's with Joe DiMaggio. It's a different story.
You went into Hollywood or Florida?
That was my condition. The first time they invited me to this synagogue, I would only come if I could meet Joe DiMaggio's handler, lawyer, public relations man, accountant, etc. This guy is an estate lawyer. When you walk in, he charges as you breathe, the sand is ticking away. So they didn't know what to do. And I told them, I don't want to go to Hollywood, but if I can meet Morris Engelberg, fine. He just published a book on DiMaggio. So they found out that DiMaggio's cardiologist is a member of the shul, Shomer Shabbos doctor. So the doctor called Morris, and you know, Morris, a cardiologist, he says to Morris, this very, I don't want to say the words, famous rabbi from Jerusalem, he wants to meet you, he grew up in the Bronx. So what could Engelberg do? At the end of 2 hours of talking and learning, he exclaimed, the rabbi knows baseball better than I do, and he gave me the most expensive gift anyone has ever given me. It hangs in my foyer, which is the second miracle that Malka let me hang it up. Anyway, coming back here, so Rabbi Feller, so Chabad is a logo. Now what does it mean it's a logo? Let me tell you, I never understood this. In this little area, there's the Young Israel, there's Eish HaTorah, and there are like five different Chabad locations. So I found out two are legitimate, three are not. And at the Shluchim conference, only two were invited, three were not. What does it mean? People need parnasa. So someone who hung his hat in the Chabad Beis Medrash, learned in the Chabad Beis Medrash, he opens up, and the minute you put up the word Chabad, people know what it means. And Israelis are attracted. They get a crowd. And what's famous about these rabbis, these Chabadnikim, they don't pressure you. they set an example. They will not bother you. They do tuta mitzvah, tuta yiddish zach. They're quoting Richard Joel. Richard Joel is quoting them. They will never go into your bones. Some of them become totally Shomer Shabbos, and others become followers, and then they run a banquet. That's how they raise money. That's how they support themselves. The central Chabad place doesn't support them. Those that are officially shluchim, I think the first 2 years, they get their salary or get part of their salary from the central Chabad shluchim, what's going on 770. But these places, it's a logo. Another Chabad place in town. And like everything else, we Jews get offended quickly. So a guy had a fight in one Chabad shul, he now has another Chabad shul. They run a journal, a banquet. They attract. I can give you one beautiful story from Bal Harbor. My last Monday night in Florida, they asked me to speak in Bal Harbor. It was a very moving occasion because they only had Bal Harbor, Florida. You're getting confused with Bell Harbor, New York. You're confusing upper middle class with multi-millionaires in Bal Harbor, where DiMaggio spent his final years. Anyway, in Bal Harbor, a tremendous crowd comes, and on 2 days' notice, and this is the Young Israel of Bal Harbor that was opened up around the corner from the biggest Chabad shul in the world. It's called The Shul. To put it up years ago cost $9 million. They say today it would run $30, $40 million to put up a similar building. It's unbelievable. So when a friend of mine, who's now the president of the Young Israel, went in Aliyah from the five towns to Bal Harbor, listen carefully. He went to the shul Shabbos. He told, I couldn't make this up. He told me the story. So he sits down, the place is mobbed, Shabbos morning, it begins like 9:30, Chabad, it finishes at 1:30. The rabbi speaks between every aliyah, everyone's eyes are focused on the rabbi. It's like God Almighty has come down from Har Sinai or Moshe Rabbeinu and speaking to the Jews. And they love him. And he's davening there 1 week, 2 weeks, and there's a guy next to him. He takes a look, this guy is davening in a black suit and a black hat and a shekel. And then the fourth week he starts talking, he says, so where do you live? So the guy tells him he lives, it's about a half hour out of Bal Harbor driving. So my friend says to him, so where do you stay for Shabbos? So he says, no, I drive. This is my rabbi. I have no other synagogue that I go to. I drive back and forth on Shabbos. So you see, here's a guy with a black hat. He may have had a gatel too. I should ask my friend if he remembers that he wore a gatel. But you see, that's Chabad. They don't, a guy like that, if he walked into my shul driving, right, I don't say I'd slap his face. But I get up in the pulpit when I felt it appropriate and give a whole talk. Al Yetzei Yushmin Komchem, last week, Pashat Yitro. Or this week, I should say. Well, it was no last week. Wait, I'm all confused. B'shalach. Where you have the man, I would say, Al Yetzei Yushmin Komchem, Shabbos is a day to return to your roots. Shabbos is a day to run away from the big world, from social interaction. Shabbos is a day where we don't drive, where we remain secluded in our dalit. I'm like, give a tremendous talk. Beautiful. All right. I don't know if I'd offend him. You know, he knows it's an Orthodox rabbi. But Chabad wouldn't give a talk like that. It's a different, if I may use a Musa word, a different daher. How do you translate that? Not just approach. It's more than an approach. It's an understanding of it. An analysis. We learned the same, but we have the same background. It's okay. Now, so he tells the story, and he says that this Chabad rabbi invited him to help sponsor the banquet. Why? Because this guy's a rocket scientist. You know, if this is someone in Washington D.C. and someone well known, and he should help out. All right. And he says, the story of our first meeting has been told often enough, it was even mentioned in Time magazine. On the surface, it looked like a comedy. A strange, bearded, black-hatted young man remembers, this guy, he says, came to his office. Imagine, he described, I'll paraphrase it. A guy walks into your office. He wants a favor from you, okay? He comes into your office. You don't know each other. It's the first time you're meeting eye to eye. And in the middle of the meeting, this black-hatted, bearded Moshe fella looks at his watch, and he says, I have to daven mincha, says, excuse me, stops the meeting, walks to a corner of the office, and davens mincha. Now imagine, this rocket scientist is sitting there, doesn't know what the hell the guy is doing. And the chutzpah, I will never forget my bewilderment and embarrassment. I didn't know what he was doing or why. I didn't know Jews prayed outside a synagogue. I didn't know they prayed in the afternoon. I didn't know they prayed on weekdays. And I didn't know how anyone could pray without someone announcing the pages. Okay? This is such a fabulous description. There are tears in my eyes. I know what happens, but it's such a fabulous description. I don't think anyone has ever said it better. You guys met with Rabbi Lipstein. I couldn't believe what I saw yesterday. I'm still shaking. Oh, Rabbi Rakepit is here. You got back. They're sitting upstairs talking with Rabbi Lipstein 7,000 miles away, one and one. So,
He
was in America, 7,000 miles away, and he sees me walk into the conference room. I wanted to see what's going on. I couldn't believe I see Rabbi Lichtenstein on the TV screen. I figured they're watching a DVD. He became an actor or something. I don't know. Every rabbi's an actor, so I figured he became a professional actor. But this description, and then he says they became friends. We discussed, we debated, we visited, we socialized. Yitzhak, we just had a quote that shook up the class for its honesty. You have to pick it up on the tape. It's beyond words. And you know, he looked at the rabbi. He's a nice guy. He's a nice kid. And you know, but he's out of touch with America. A beard, a black hat, getting up in the middle of a meeting. Could you imagine you're going for an interview for a job. You need a favor from this heavyweight lawyer. And in the middle, sitting with the lawyer, you say, oh, it's time to daven mincha, pardon me. By the way, you know where this is famous in memoir literature in America? There was a Jewish lawyer, it's 150 years ago, 140 years ago, not Brandeis, if anyone can remember the name. It may be Brandeis. And he was in court. I have to check who it was. It was in the 1890s in Philadelphia. It could be. I know from his great granddaughter. I saw the story in print. Who could it be? No. It's after Cardoza. It's after Katoza. I taught his great granddaughter Michlala. So he asked the judge for a 10-minute recess. He has to daven mincha, and the judge granted it on the spot, 10 minutes, so that the council can say the afternoon prayers. Not a problem. He explained to the judge. So I mean, this story is unbelievable. Now, so he becomes more Jewish conscious, but not more religious. Then what happens? The summer of 1963, I'm invited to participate as a member of the American delegation in an international conference on space research in Poland. Wow. My balloon-borne samplers had discovered viable microorganisms in the stratosphere at a time when the field of exobiology was too full of speculation and embarrassingly lacking in real biological data. Now, this is 1963. You have to understand, the Cold War, this is, and I wouldn't say the height of the Cold War, because the height was in the 50s, but this was Vietnam.
Missile crisis.
Yeah, so you're right, this is the height of the Cold War. All right, the height of the Cold War. And he's invited, a Jew. There's a whole delegation. The Poles want information. And he and Gail decide to go. They leave the three children with his parents in Canada. They fly to Warsaw. It was a dismal visit. In those years, the city had not yet recovered from the destruction of World War II. physical destruction was evident in the piles of rubble that covered huge sections of the city. The emotional destruction was worse. The indigenous Polish anti-Semitism, which had been fueled generously by the German occupation, was now being nurtured by the Jewish hatred of the new Russian masters. And he did, you know, this is absolutely true. The Poles, you know, when you speak with survivors, I can tell you one thing, you don't know who hated the Jews more. You speak with the Polish survivors, they'll tell you stories of how the Poles killed their Jewish neighbors. You speak with the Lithuanians, the Ukrainians, you'll speak with the Latvians. The hatred that came out was unbelievable. We see today, in the year 2012, the hatred for the Jew, it's beyond words. All right, they claim they hate Israel. But you all know what it means. I told Nachum before class, if you saw today's New York Times, there's an article on the turmoil in the Arab world, and I couldn't believe the article. It doesn't blame the Jews. Israel is hardly mentioned in the article. We have, Baruch Hashem, a nes katan. But they come to Poland, and what is left there? A handful of Jews. There's no religion whatsoever. And he tells the story how they go to the cemetery. And at the cemetery, he visits the tomb of Peretz, the great Jewish writer, Yehuda Leib Peretz. And of course, he says, I could appreciate, Yitzchak Leib Peretz, I should say, I studied, what did my wife know about this? She was a Reformed background. She was never affected. Through it all, I wondered how Gail was being affected. After all, I was a product of the old country culture of Winnipeg. She came from the sterile culture of Southern California's Reformed temples. Peretz and Shalamash and Warsaw were part of my upbringing. How was all this moving her? And then they describe Shabbos afternoon, how people they met at the Jewish cemetery came to visit them. What was the man looking for? A handout. The children knew nothing of Yiddishkeit. And we, at least, he says, had a Passover Haggadah, and they knew absolutely nothing of Yiddish. And then he describes that night, Gail sat up in her bed where she had been crying and spoke the most firm words I ever heard in 7 years of marriage. I don't know what you think, and I don't really care, but I made up my mind. And as soon as we get back, I'm going to ask Moshe, in brackets, Rabbi Fella, to make our home kosher. We're the only ones left. There's no one else. If we lose it, if we don't do it, if our children don't know anything about it, there won't be any Jews anymore. You can do what you want, but our house is going to be Jewish. And imagine, this is a girl coming from a Reformed background. It was a defiant proclamation, and she meant it. The pictures, the books, and the music were not enough. She intended to transform the house organically, its very essence. Moreva, she was as good as her word. When we arrived in Minneapolis, that's where they lived. The first person she called was Rabbi Fella, and he was only too willing to comply. Well, I don't have to tell you. The rest is history. And there's a beautiful story here about the dishes that they couldn't kosher, very expensive dishes. I don't know.
China, right.
Kosher. And Rabbi Fella didn't want to tell her right away, relax, she should throw the dishes out. So he told her it's a very difficult china had a kosher. She has to get guidance in New York. Whenever he went to New York, she would say, did you get guidance? Oh, I forgot to ask. A few years later, she sold the dishes to her neighbors, a Gentile, and she bought 2 shekels with the money she got. for the dishes. And he goes on to say how he kept kosher at home. Outside, he would eat anything. And within a few years, the whole transformation took place. Now, there's something else here that's very powerful that none of you will understand unless you have a Hasidic feeling. And this is the tragedy of Lubavitch. Not appointing it ever. You see, what the seventh Rebbe had, they were Fabrengen. How many of you had a Fabrengen at Lubavitch? How could you be at a Fabrengen? Well, how old are you, David? What are you playing games with? When are you at a Fabrengen?
Oh, never been, or?
I'm not talking about it.
Yeah,
about it
then.
You've been where?
I've never been.
Who has been at 770 at a Fabrengen? When were you there?
I mean, with 2 years ago. Oh, no, the Rebbe.
God, he's
not there. But the Rebbe's still there.
You asked?
I got to ask. I don't mean with the TV. I know the Rebbe's there. He's there. But you walk in.
No,
you walk in.
And they move apart. And then you walk in.
I know. At the Messianic Minyan. It's not all the Minyan. I told you, Leib Bayis was there, and they give the Rebbe. Give the Rebbe shishi.
And then what?
They part, they let the Rebbe come over.
It's a big thing.
The Gabbai answers her name to the brachas, and they lay him. You, it's like you just spoke up what they're capable of. But that's the joke, that they want to give the Rebbe hagbar. Give the Rebbe hagbar. Anyway, but when the Rebbe was alive, a fabrengen was unbelievable. Thousands and thousands of people came.
In your book.
The Rebbe came in 1980, but thousands came, and you had to see who came. It's not like you come into YU and the davening the base medrash face, and 80% of the kids have black hats. Chabad was so multilithic. You can't believe the crowd. All the politicians were there, Jewish and Gentile, and the Gentile politicians, the Chabad leaders assigned translators that would sit next to them and explain. And you had Israelis, and you had artists, and you had Jacques Lifshitz, the famous sculptor. You have no idea what went on. And you see Rabbi Green, Rabbi Feller, sent Professor Velvele Green go to a Fabrengen. Now, a Fabrengen had tremendous power. Why? Because you grew up where? Mount Vernon. How many from families were there? Yitzchak, you grew up in Boston. How many from families were there? Come on, thousands of Jewish families. How many Shomer Shabbos? Nachum Lamb's father grew up in the Bronx. Ribbono Shel Olam, how many from families were there in the Bronx where we grew up? If there were five in an area of 20 miles, I'm overstating the case. But when you come to a Fabrengen, thousands of Jews, Shomer Mitzvot, looking at the Rebbe, and the impact was unbelievable. And this Velvel Green, whatever his real first name was, goes on to become a total chassid with a long beard, raising a fabulous family, comes an aliyah professor today he's 70, he's in his late 70s, professor emeritus at the University of Minnesota and Ben Gurion University in the Negev, and he was a principal scientist for NASA. He worked on the Moon Project, etc. And he says, my first sight of the Rebbe was at a Fabrengen, a lively Hasidic event where the Rebbe would speak. I was in New York on business, and Rabbi Feller called to say a Fabrengen would be held at Chabad headquarters. He said I should go. So I did. The Rebbe spoke in Yiddish, so I understood the words, but I didn't have enough Jewish knowledge to comprehend most of it, the sources he was lacking. The Hola went amazed me. There was the Rebbe, educated in math and science himself and spoke of the soul as something real, not just an idea. And listening to his every word were over 1,000 chassidim, working guys, just like me. But for them, everything the Rebbe said had critical importance for their lives. Green's first personal audience with the Rebbe took place in 1963. My appointment was at 10 p.m., and this was when, and again, the Rebbe was young, and he would, all night he would receive people. I mean, you can't conceive. You fellas who grew up in a world where everyone says Lubavitch, they smirk. You don't realize who the Rebbe was, what he accomplished. It's a crime, I told the Messianic young chassid, your age, collecting funds for some chveis yeshiva that he organized, is, I don't know here, where, Israel, America. I told him, you are sinning against your Rebbe's memory. And I quoted, someone had told me from Brooklyn last summer, min gunumen a greiser Rebbe und gemacht von mir a kleiner Mashiach. You took a great Rebbe and you made out of him a small Mashiach. Because you fellas don't know who the Rebbe was. And he describes, 10 p.m., I wasn't nervous, more awed. The Rebbe was so warm and welcoming. He seemed more like a loving uncle than the spiritual leader of the Jewish world. He asked if I was familiar with the Hasidic principle of Hashgacha Pratis, divine providence. Everything that a person sees or hears is designed by God to bring us closer to Him. I didn't quite believe that, but the Rebbe said for me it was especially important. You work in the space program. You're a professor in a medical school. You travel, you see and hear things most people don't experience. Why don't you keep a journal, not just a few notes at the end of the day, and see if you can find the divine message. If you need help, bring it to me. Isn't that good? That's so powerful, so insightful. In today, Gail and Velvel Green live in Be'er Sheva and recently celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary. Quote, in Israel we have 3 daughters and 20 grandchildren. Both our sons are Chabad Lubavitch emissaries in the United States with many more grandchildren there. We are a very close family. My most lasting memory of the Rebbe was on our 10th anniversary in 1966 when we went for his blessing. Quote, my bracha blessing for you, the Rebbe said, is to remember that there's an old man in Brooklyn who thinks about you and invites you to come back on your 20th anniversary for another bracha. So this is a case study so revealing because Professor Velvel Green is so insightful. But you see, a Jew who's not religious, who grows up without a Rebbe, without Torah, they're not rebellious. It's not enmity. It's not hatred. And somehow we have to reach them. The Lubavitcher Rebbe was a master. One of the greatest stories is Shlomo Kalbach. When Kalbach was still a Lubavitcher, and you know Shlomo, I knew him from Lakewood. I knew him afterwards. It was a different world. If you want a little insight from Rakefe, I knew Kalbach very well. I knew Yitz Greenberg. I knew David Hartman intimately. I knew the Rebbetzin very well from Bnei Akiva with her whole family. I just got regards from
which Rebbetz?
Rebbetzin Yungreis.
Oh, all right.
I just got regards, Esther, you know, I just got regards from her brother on this past Shabbos. He heard I was staying in this house in Flatbush. Broody Yungreis. I couldn't believe how we knew the whole Malka and I told him about the whole thing. I knew all these people, Shleimelaka, and you see, these people were raised like I was raised in the shadow of World War II, the State of Israel. They wanted to change the world. They wanted to make every Jew from their desires were overwhelmingly good. How they turned out, some, each one went his own way, and some we are not so happy with, some we have to understand, some we're happy with. Shlomo was out to get every Jew, and he had quite a background. He was a Yekka, it's the Kalbach family. It's not a small matter when you talk about the Kalbach family. He learned in Litvishi Yeshiva in Chaim Berlin, and then afterwards in Lakewood, and then he became a Lubavitcher for a while. So one of the stories Shlomo told, I have a recording of Shlomo when the Lubavitcher Rebbe died. I don't know where this was recorded, it circulated privately, an amazing recording where he's off the cuff talking about the Rebbe. So he tells the story that he was on the subway, Shlomo Kalbach, and he sees this Jewish kid on the subway, and he starts a discussion with the kid about Yiddishkeit. The kid knows nothing, and he rides with the kid, he goes home, and then he takes it, says, you know what, I'm going to take you to see the greatest Jew alive. And at 2 in the morning, this is the early 50s when the Rebbe was accessible, 2 in the morning he brings the kid into the Rebbe, and the Rebbe's with the kid for the next 3 hours, and his whole life is changed. And the next time the Rebbe sees Shlomo, I don't know, he says something as follows to him, next time when you bring me a fish that has to be scraped and, you know, cleaned up and gotten ready for Shabbos, bring them a little earlier than 2 a.m. in the morning. But that was the period, that was gold. And that has to be our attitude. And the Ribbono Shel Olam should help us. We should be matzliach in the rabbinate, be matzliach in chinuch. And you have to know, even kids raised from, they're exposed to so much different influence. A kid from Torah Shraga asked me yesterday as a friend, yeshiva boy, so the kid already is, you know, post high school, already God is dead, God doesn't exist, there's no Torah, there's no revelation, it's all a bluff, all that counts is man. How do you deal with it? So, you know, first of all, you can't get upset, you can't be angry. This is the New York Times, what do you want out of the kid? This is Bill Clinton. This is the way so many famous people live. And you have to quote to the kid Marx and Engels, the famous quote, God is man is God. And then let it sink in. You know what that quote means? There's no God, there's no law. You do whatever you want. You set the laws, you set the ethics, you set the morals. Look what happens when man is the ultimate moral setter. Look what we have. Look what I said to Rabbi Rubin yesterday, and for once he admitted the Rebbe is right. With the Tanya, you went here yesterday, with the Behaima Nafshit, with the guy. I said, after the Holocaust, I have no problem with the Tanya. My question is, how did we have Gentiles like Sempo Sungihara, or like who is the ambassador to Hungary who saved so many Jews? Raoul Wallenberg. What an individual. What an individual. I know people who were saved by Wallenberg. I know 3 brothers and their mother and father saved by Wallenberg. Today it's a big family, but literally saved by Wallenberg. And then it's beyond words what these Gentiles did. God should give them the highest Gan Eden. So we have to reach out. A kid who talks like that, you got to let him talk. And then you have to talk with him. You have to explain, look what happens when you have no morals. Look how the Jew has survived. Isn't Jewish history a testimony to God? The fact that you're here, the fact that you question, you're seeking, you're searching the soul, etc. But you have to have patience. And there's a lot we can learn from Chabad. This Rabbi Moshe Feller, who I don't believe I ever met, I've met fellas, but I don't recall a Moshe Feller Chabadnik. What a schut. You know him? I can't hear? Bob Feller, Zichron Lebracha just died. It's a different world. He was an Iowa farm boy. But he's a different story. But Fella, I know fellas from Chaim Berlin, it's a name that caught on among Jewish people. It probably is a name they gave them when they came into America at Ellis Island, and the name caught on. Okay, I just want to go one step further and then come into modern times. The problem...
So we have sources in Jewish history.
Yeah.
Where we did associate with non-religious Jews and we learned from them, even a mayor, a lacher, I mean, it isn't like you know, we have to distance ourselves.
No, no.
For example, in Philadelphia, I was a member of the Board of Rabbis.
Yeah.
One of the Reform rabbis who was very influential sat on the board of a Jewish hospital, quote unquote. They were all discussing should they or shouldn't they provide kosher for Jewish patients. And his point was they thought he would say no because he didn't. We must, he said.
But
why did that happen? Only because of the impact of the information trips over the years.
I agree with you in theory. On a practical level, each case has to be judged individually. I'll give you a simple example. Limud. Limud has now become an international affair. And
what is that?
Limud. Lala Jud Mem Bav
Dalet. London.
It began in London. Today it's in America and
what
Russia.
Is it?
They run 3 days or a whole long weekend of hundreds of different classes. And it's strictly kosher, glatt kosher, as a matter of fact. But the classes are Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, Reconstructionist,
pluralistic
with a capital P.
Okay.
Every type of class under the sun. Now, do you participate? And this is, I can only tell you I refused. But I can tell you, Rabbi Lamb participates. The Chief Rabbi of London does not participate. Chief Rabbi of the British Empire does not participate. You say it's not right. Now, what is the problem? The problem is very simple. Room 101 is Rakefet speaking about there's only one Torah. Tradition. Room 102 is the conservative rabbi, tradition and change. Room 103, a Reform rabbi who needs tradition. It undermines the Jews' acceptance into the world. And this is a serious problem, because the message you are giving is that we're all equal.
No.
You say it's not...
America didn't want to recognize China, as if China didn't exist. We're living in a world today in which we have an opportunity to touch people. If we're going to play games and not touch anybody...
That's the other side. That's what Rabbi Lamb said.
By definition, the Orthodox rabbi stands for certain things. He's there, but they know that.
Gentlemen, you have a point. I agree. I personally, I got burned and scarred the one weekend the OU finagled me into going to that hotel at the Jewish Parliament Convention. What do they call it? The Jewish Parliament. You correct? Tell me what
I don't know
the name. And these are Jews from all over the world, the World Zionist Organization, Jews that have some commitment. And I thought I'm the only rabbi there. At this hotel, they're placing an Orthodox rabbi for Shabbos. Fine. So I go to the hotel. First of all, I see a lady checking in with my own eyes. I'm listening. I'm eavesdropping again, which I shouldn't do, but some of my best insights come from eavesdropping. And the lady is saying to the girl behind the desk, "Oh," she says, "do you have a Shabbos elevator? My granddaughter's coming, and she won't take the regular elevator. This woman is so upset. I wanted to go over. Lady, you should dance for joy. Baruch Hashem that your granddaughter knows what Shabbos is and you don't. How are you zochet to something like that?" And she's apologizing. That's minor. Then I look for davening. I see this guy with a beard, with a big kippah through guy. I say, "What time is it?" He says, "Oh, you don't want my prayer group." He says, "You daven with the hotel." I go to the hotel. It's Svardim, fine, quick davening, 1, 2, 3. It's Rabbi Avadya's hotel, the one in Manscopus. So it's Svard, the kitchen Svard, the kechsher, everything fine, good. So I had about an hour. Now Shabbos began at 4:30. Dinner is at 7. So I sat in the hallway outside my room where there was light, and I had a Gemara with me, not a problem. 7 o'clock, Malka and I are going to dinner, and this guy with the big kippah, with the beard, turns out he's the Reform rabbi, and he's finishing the Reform service, and 300 committed ladies who are here because they're part of the World Zionist Movement are lighting Shabbos candles 3.5 hours after Shabbos began. And I saw the sight, I saw the candles, I saw the lighting. My eyes hurt me until today. But I have to tell you, that at the meal, this rabbi was working for the agency, they took over the reform, and he gives a whole drush, and he welcomes the different streams of Judaism that are present, and I'm welcoming the Orthodox rabbi. Chabad is welcomed. I then learned that Chabad is a different stream. They're not considered Orthodox. This Reform rabbi agrees with Rav Shach. You understand? What did Rav Shach say? The nearest thing to Yiddishkeit is Chabad. He agrees. The conservative, the Reform. But you know what's amazing? So when I speak that night, and a little crowd comes, there are different crowds here, different crowds there. So I had a number of Balei Tshuva from Atlanta, Georgia. So I say to them, didn't it bother you, the lighting of the candles and Shabbat? They say, they don't know any better. They don't know any better. They were so forgiving. Their attitude was so different than mine. It's not that I was angry at the people. I was angry at the rabbi. And it was so upsetting to me. And these Balei Tshuva, no, they don't know any better. We have to teach them. Yitzchak, there's
room. Their grandchildren will be the ones who will use the Shabbos
elevator. Be'ezrat Hashem. There's room for both opinions. I'm not
if
here.
I had an invitation to Limud, I would go.
Okay. I just got another invitation to Limud, and I double-talked my way into a stalemate for the time being.
Okay.
Because I would, in England it's very easy, because the chief rabbi doesn't go. So when I was there last time, they organized an Orthodox limud around my being there as scholar in residence.
What does he gain by not going? He has a gift of gab.
It's a
he has a golden gab.
Okay, that, it doesn't.
Yeah, that could be a bubble sphere.
Yeah, with all that you're saying, he is declaring you have a choice. You can be Orthodox, conservative, Reform, Reconstructionist, liberal, humanistic.
Justifying
you have no choice.
The same thing, Hirsch and Hildesheim.
It could very well be, and I'm still don't know who is right. They're not Hirsch and Hildesheim, Hirsch and Rabbi Bamberger, Rabbi Yitzchak. Hildesheim is stood in the middle. Anyway, let me go one step further. Part of the tremendous problem that we have today, and this is why the assimilation becomes greater and greater, and everyone makes the same comment. The inner core is stronger than ever. Wherever you go today, South Africa, Australia, Canada, America, Russia for that matter, wherever you go, the inner core is stronger and larger than ever. The outer core, the assimilation is beyond words. Now, there are many reasons why that has happened. First of all, 30, 40, 50 years ago, Jews were repelled by their children into marrying. In order to placate their parents, I don't know what the statistics are, but I would venture a guess, at least 80% of the time, there was conversion to Judaism. The minute there was conversion to Judaism, so you have a kid being raised in a home where both parents are practicing Jews. I'm not saying they're Orthodox, far from it, but both parents were practicing Jews. And the kid is getting a solid message that he is Jewish. Today, according to the statistics, less than 20% of the intermarried families convert. Any conversion whatsoever. The grandparents of 50 years ago were gone. The parents of today could not care less. Intermarriage is an accepted phenomenon. You saw it with your own eyes when Clinton's daughter married a Jew on Shabbos, and the whole American Jewish community, including graduates of this kollel, danced with joy that a Jewish person can marry royalty. Right or wrong?
Wrong.
What's wrong?
I don't think everybody danced with joy.
I'm not talking about our world. And from this very kollel, one of our graduates who has a very important rabbinical position said, with all our heartache that they get married on Shabbos, one cannot be, but I'm paraphrasing him, but happy and proud that a Jew could marry the daughter of the President of the United States. Quote, end quote. So, you see today, it's now, how does this reflect? Watch the statistics. How does this reflect? Well, kids are growing up in homes where there are two religions. And even if the parents are not believers, but if the mother is not Jewish, or the father is not Jewish, and the grandparents are not Jewish, and you have Christmas and Easter, the kids are assimilating infinitely more than the intermarriages of 50 years ago. And this whole question of intermarriage families, you all know, is now being reflected in every rabbinical group. What do we do? Who can be a member? Until modern times, the conservative movement would not allow an intermarried family to be members of conservative synagogues. Today already there's a breakdown. What aliyah, what honor do you give an intermarried family? What do you do at a bar mitzvah where the father is not Jewish? Don't we already have in all conservative temples, they give them hagbah, they give them glila, they call them up to the amid. This is something that didn't go on. And even renegades in the Orthodox world, we have people today, it was a big article months ago, with two renegades, with two synagogues, they give them hagbah, they give them glila, they stand next to the boy reading the Torah, they stand next to their daughter reading the Torah. And this problem, this assimilation, is just all the more intense. And you face the tragedy of the inner core more powerful than ever, and the outer core less Jewish identity than ever. In the state of Israel, to a smaller degree, it's a similar phenomenon. Because the original Jews that came here, like Ben Gurion, the socialists, the Mapainikim, Golda Meir stated in public, 69, 70, I forget, one of my early years here, when she was prime minister and spoke to the people with her Yom Kippur message, she said, a Jew who does not feel the uniqueness of Yom Kippur is no longer connected to the Jewish people, quote, end quote. I challenge you today to find a secular Jew who will speak like that. There are two more generations removed from Yom Kippur, from Yiddishkeit, from Kedusha. Ben Gurion, as much as he didn't observe Yiddishkeit, would never, ever worship in a Reform temple. And this was known. Excuse me?
Here.
I can't hear what you're saying.
Here.
And today already you have, don't want to mention names, famous politicians, their children got married in the big Reform temple in North Tel Aviv. Famous politicians, let them be nameless. So this is a real problem that we have today. This is a fabulous article that appeared in the Jerusalem Report, September 5th, 1996. And it deals with this very problem. Said Barbara, New York area grandmother of two mixed Jewish Gentile children who did not want her last name printed, quote, but now all my friends have intermarried kids. She and her husband had no real trouble accepting her Gentile son-in-law, she says, quote, because we're crazy about him. And then the article goes in, how do you celebrate? Stranger prematurations of Jewish families abound. The Nunnelies of Dunnelly, New Jersey celebrate Jewish holidays, not Christmas, and consider theirs a Jewish household, even though Father Dale believes in Jesus. Now this is a quote from him. Jesus was a Jew who went to a Passover Seder before he was crucified, observed Dale. If he had no problem with it, why should I? In fact, says his wife Eileen, it was Dale who insisted that their adopted Korean son be raised exclusively as a Jew. Listen to this. The Nunnalees had their son converted under Orthodox auspices, quote, so that he can be any kind of Jew he wants to be, says Dale. Dale is more religious than me, and he wanted our son to have religion, Eileen says. I would have said, let's give him both. But Dale thought it was wrong to mix religions. You see the problems here? These are intelligent people. And take a look. The kid was converted under Orthodox auspices, and here he is in a home where the mother is Jewish, the father is not, and there's very little Jewish observance. These are problems. There's no telling when Jewish feeling may emerge. Jennifer Mailman, a 35-year-old legal secretary, is married to a Gentile. So was her father, who raised her as a Reformed Jew. For years, she said, I practiced no religion and belonged to no community. But as I got older, I realized that rituals mean a great deal to me. I found great comfort in reciting the prayers. So she now joined the Reformed synagogue and emphatically considers herself Jewish, although she knows she is not by halachic standards. And yeah, they see the problems.
Mother
wasn't Jewish. Father was intermarried. She is intermarried. And these problems abound. She says the prayers speak to her.
Amen.
But you never know.
Listen. It's article. The complications diminish, but don't disappear when the new Jewish spouse converts. The rate of conversion among Gentiles who marry Jews has been dropping steeply. It's currently no more than 10%, a third of what it was before 1970. I thought it was 18%, 10%. And a 29-year-old Washington, D.C. lawyer converted to Judaism after she married Joey, same age, same profession. They plan to raise their children as Jews. Nonetheless, says Joey, my child will have Catholic grandparents. It's hard to know how to make that work without undermining how we are trying to raise them. Their compromise solution, the children will be allowed to join their Christian relatives for home-based rituals like decorating Christmas trees and hunting Easter eggs, but not to go to church. All right, I can go on and on with the article.
In February and in April.
I can go on and on. I'll tell you what I just mentioned. You have no idea how important this is. I'll tell you a word that you'll never forget. This is you don't realize what we just said. Let me just analyze it for 1 second. You know, a Christmas dinner, Easter eggs. What's wrong with it? It binds families. There's emotion. If you don't have a happy childhood, you're going to need guidance and help all your life. So let me tell you a little story. In my first congregation, there was a lady who had converted to Judaism and married a Jewish boy. He's no longer alive. Went on to become a very well-known professor. They came in Aliyah when we did. And she once said a word. They were discussing in the Baruch Lichtenstein's home, Pashat Emor, the whole concept that a Kohen can't marry a convert. What's wrong with a convert? Why can't a Kohen marry her? And she said something so insightful. She said, a Kohen in the Torah represents the religious teacher. The Kohen represents the rabbi, spiritual personality. She said, a convert, even if she believes in Torah with all her heart and observes all the mitzvah, and she did and does, but she still will have warm feelings of the Christmas dinner, of the Easter eggs. It's family. It's like we think back to family reunions, Pesach, Hanukkah. She said, that cannot go with a Kohen. And that's something you can't eradicate. We once asked the Rav, it's a very difficult question. Someone converts. What relationship do they retain with their parents, their siblings? It's a very delicate question. There's not a black and white answer. I'm a human being, you know, I don't want to come and say, uproot all the good feeling and hate the Christmas dinner and hate the egg roll. Right? You don't go to church.
In light of what's written in all of Mishnah's Vodazon, you have to keep
But they're claiming, but you're not reading, they're claiming it as you see in America.
Is there Kibbutz Abayim?
One second. You hit the nail on there, but I just want to answer you. This is secular. In America today, what did the courts rule? You can put up a Christmas tree, it's not a religious act. This is a holiday season, but it's not necessarily religious. Isn't this what the courts rule? This is what the menorah, when Chabad fights for menorahs.
So they did in Russia, the communist war. They call them the winter.
Right, Poseidon. So you see here you can avoid religion. That's exactly what that lady says. We reached the compromise, the kids can go to the family Christmas dinner, it's their cousins. They can go to the egg roll, but not to the church. You understand? There's a difference. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah, it depends if the fast, if you can sell, if you can't sell. It depends if
the Stamin.
No, that's Lahar Chakar.
That's what I'm saying. No, you're asking
you asked a wonderful question, the ultimate question. Because look, Al Pidin, Geshen Gayer, Kitinuk Shinol Adomi. So it's not his father, it's not his mother. Like we said yesterday, Ma'ika Hadin, Anusat Aviv is muteret to the son. But still it bothers you. Here, Allah had come of a comma, it's still your parents. And what do you do? So I can tell you, I'm not paskening you, every case has to be judged individually. So I can tell you one story out of the old city. There's, I don't know this person's background, he teaches. You know, there's a tremendous industry today, I use the word in quotes, of teaching the Balei Tshuva, of outreach and Balei Tshuva. And this person runs a yeshiva. I daven with him during the summer Friday night. We don't know each other intimately, but I know him. Every Friday night I talk with him, and he seemed very capable, very learned, very pious. So I notice his children look like Afro-Americans. He obviously is married to a Afro-American lady. If I put together the few words he told me and I decipher it, he was not religious at all, typical Jew, everything we're talking about today. And he met this Afro-American lady who had converted to Judaism, like I spoke about yesterday in class about what I saw in Las Vegas, and she made him religious, went on the journey with him, came to Israel. Children are all from what I see, davening, know how to daven, 100%. They're steeped in it. And recently, her mother died. So he asked the shaila of his Rebbe if he should go to the funeral. And, you know, his wife is going back, and he's a son-in-law. And the Rebbe said, absolutely. You go, you can't go into the church, but these people raised your daughter. You have to
get
a chorus at top, exactly. And he told me about the funeral, that the minister was like angry. The rabbi is standing there, and he said, you know, like you took away the family from whatever, Protestantism, and you brought them to Judaism. But these are very delicate questions. And when you have grandparents who are not Jew, how do you deal with it? How do you explain it? How do you raise a kid? And you see, this article, what the article is really alluding to, forget about the assimilated Jews, forget about the intermarriage, but even where they come back to Yiddishkeit, look at the problems they have that we never dreamt of. And it's a result of modernity and where we stand.
I had a fellow called me.
Yeah.
His wife was a geologist. She's She's a nurse. The family is very poor. They're living somewhere in Minnesota.
Right.
And so she could she go back and take care of her mother? Of course, okay. She does go back. Then she calls me long distance. Her mother died. Can she attend the funeral? I says, don't go to the funeral. To help the family.
Don't go to the church, you mean?
To the church. Don't go to the service. She called me back a month later when she returned. She said, you have no idea the Kiddush Hashem. First of all, they didn't know what happened that I became Jewish. Then they saw that being Jewish means you're kind and you're caring.
Right, right.
And she said they had a whole different attitude because of her being there and being supported.
Right, no, Beseda, absolutely, 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 absolutely. Okay, anyway, to summarize so far, we're moving into the big leagues, but we'll just scratch it today. I think you'll all agree that the article on the Velvel Green, Professor Green, I think I've met him over the years. If I'm not mistaken, I think he's also lectured for YU. He may even have an honorary doctorate, and it has to be checked. It's a magnificent article, and it gives you insight how a person not raised in Torah thinks. And we have to live with that thinking, because these are the people we have to educate, these are the people we have to reach out to. And you remember the classic story I told you with the kids playing, writing with the chalk on Shabbos? And the revered Rabbi Arya Leib Grusness comes home from Shul Shabbos morning. Av Beit Din of London, lived in my building in retirement for many years. A Gaon Adir, Leib Arya, look at his Svarim, look at the way Rabbi Moshe, Rabbi Leib Grusness.
Grusness?
Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, a little Tishuk, who wound up in England but became an English gentleman, spoke the Queen's English. And look at the titles Rav Moshe writes them, gives them more titles than anyone else that Rav Moshe answers questions. They're shyness from him to Rav Moshe, where I live, Christmas from London. And he says to the kids, in his, you know, his Anglo-Hebrew, Shabbat Hayom, Asur, Lishtamesh in gear. And the kids answer him, innocent kids, Anachnu Lo Datiyim. You know, and those kids, what they were answering, literally, is a world of thought we don't have to observe. It's only you. You choose to be dati, or in the American sense, or as Velvel Green put it, you choose to be orthodox. That's your choice. We don't have to observe. We have freedom of choice. And the American Jew lacks that whole concept of halakha. Yes. No, no, yes. Why should man limit himself? Why can't man eat everything? Why should man not work on Shabbat? Why can't man have relations with a woman who's a nidah? What's the big deal? Why should she have to go to mikvah? And of course, you translate that into modern life. I don't have to tell you. Everything, everything. As long as I don't break windows, it's all permissible. It's the mentality we have to deal with. The problem of assimilation becomes infinitely worse because today you're raising children whose grandparents are practicing Catholics, practicing Protestants. Fine, they'll accept the fact that their daughter or son married a Jew. The Jew certainly will accept it today. It's not the shonder it was 40, 50 years ago when they swept it under the carpet. Today, you open up the New York Times on Sunday, see how many intermarriages are listed. Compare that to 50 years ago, when it was a shanda. And this is the reality of where we're dealing. But, my dear students, there's one message that has to come across. Torah is a precious gift to us, and a tremendous responsibility. Smicha, and I've often encouraged, if you're going to be a medical doctor, I'm going to be a dentist, I'm going to be a lawyer, I'm going to be in high finance, I'm going to be an accountant, and in computers, and whatever, it's still important to get smicha. Because life has taught me, someone who gets smicha feels the responsibility more of perpetuating Yiddishkeit. And today the challenges are great. Mendelssohn came out of the ghetto. He faced his challenges. Today, we're living in such a beautiful world. Most of us only feel anti-Semitism in a secondary fashion. We don't feel it right in our faces. Somehow we feel the world has accepted us. It's beautiful civilization. The New York Times, the culture, the Western world, the ability that a little Jewish boy can study whatever he wants. And that we had a Jew who was a candidate for the vice presidency of the United States, am I correct or not? A Shomer Shabbos Jew. And I can tell you, his mother once smacked my face, and she was right. I was scholar in residence in his home shul in Connecticut. The rabbi is my student, and I'm introduced to his mother Friday night at the Shabbat. And I say to his mother, wow, what an achievement to raise a son who's a United States Senator. And she says to me, no, that's not my achievement. My achievement is to have raised a son who is a Shomer Shabbos, despite all the challenges of life and America. And it's a fabulous world today. But the culture beckons to us. And chas v'chalila, we forget the Rav's Torah that I mentioned back in August when I started structuring my lectures on Reform and Conservative. Ger v'tosha anochi imachem. And we have to know what we can take and what we have to reject. And at times, our native reaction is the opposite of the halacha, of the halachic dicta. It's very simple. Why? Because who are we? What had more influence on us? Where did we spend more hours? Think for a moment. You've gone to school, elementary day school, yeshiva high school, a year in Israel, college, university. Did you spend more hours learning Torah or more hours in the Western world? And we read and we see and we're a culture and we watch television. Take the Seinfelds, four Jewish actors. One of them coming from a very rich Jewish background. His cousins were Aaron Rakefet's students. And what's the message you get? Jerry Son, what's the message you get? Jason Alexander, what's the message you get? No responsibility. Do whatever you want. A woman is a mere object. Sex, meaningless, like eating a place potato chips. I think that message. And we watched her. We laughed at Seinfeld. We laughed. Understand? Just think. But there's a message there. And this
absorbed.
It's absorbed, but willy-nilly, all of us. I'm not giving you, I'm talking about myself. I'm not talking about you. Chas v'chalil. I'm not chay shishir. Anyone watches Seinfeld on television? All I can tell you is when I got up to speak in Cape Town, I said, Baruch Hashem, that you watch television. There are about 1,200 people in the audience is looking at me. I said, if not for television, you could not understand one word of what I'm saying. I don't understand one word of your English. You ever hear the South Africans, the way they speak English, it's impossible to understand one word. It makes the limeys from England look good. But I couldn't believe it. I said, in my hotel room, I see Seinfeld here. You understand Seinfeld without living on the Upper West Side? How can you comprehend Seinfeld? But at least you master American English and you can understand me. And this is the Rav's Torah I want to end off today. And this is the famous talk that the Rav gave. He spoke about it in Parshat Korach so magnificently. We miss the Rav so because we don't have a focal figure today that everyone respects. Today you have the right, the left, and everyone is pulling and yelling and shouting. The Rav opened his mouth, everyone was quiet. Now, the Rav is very liberal. He only opened his mouth occasionally. He was very broad. He understands difference of opinion. He can understand Rabbi Mercy. He can understand Rabbi Hollander. He can understand pro-synagogue counselor, anti-synagogue counselor. He did, but when he opened his mouth, the mechitzah issue, the ecumenical issue, when the Rav opened his mouth, everyone got the message. We miss him today. we miss him today. Rakefit can say this and this. I don't mention other names. This one says that. Pays your nickel and takes your choice. Period. But the Rav gave a talk on Parshat Korach. He said, what was the machloket Korach and Moshe Rabbeinu? Talit shekulo tchelet. Right or wrong, the Tanchum, it's Yerushalmi as well. Talit shekulo tchelet. Chayev and Sitzit. Not Chayev and Sitzit. Bayit molei svarim. Chayev and Rizuzet. Not Chayev. Vaheret shekulo, etc. And the Rav said, Korach said, common sense wins out. Common sense. If you have a room that's empty and you put up one mezuzah, you ought to have a room filled with 1,000 svarim. What do you need a mezuzah for? Talit is all blue. What do you need tzitzit for? Blue tzitzit. Common sense. Western culture. New York Times. Moshe Rabbeinu said, no, that when it comes to Torah, we surrender to the divine will. It has its own system, its own categories, its own rhythm, its own heartbeat, its own pulse. And we have to give up common sense, the marketplace sense, the mercantile understanding. You understand? That's a business person, common sense. When it comes to Torah, Torah at times has to dictate to us. And we have to surrender. And we have to acknowledge that not always do we understand everything. At times, the Western influence is greater than the Torah. But this is what Torah says. I have to surrender. Ger v'tosha v'nachim v'nachim. And that was the machloket Torah from Moshe Rabbeinu. And the Rav developed it so beautifully with chukim, and then his famous talk on Parshat chukim, and why are there chukim in the Torah, and how the Rav said to his father, how come there's teiku? Remember that father? The Rav asked Rav Moshe, how can it be that Chazal had teiku? They understood everything, they knew everything. And Rav Moshe says to his son, to teach us a lesson, that not always can we understand everything. Even Chazal at times had to say teiku. That's why they're chukim in the Torah. We have many questions at times. The Rav spoke about the Holocaust, and it was a famous Yahrzeit Rosh in the mid-50s. I still remember word by word what the Rav was saying in the Agada, and who can understand the Holocaust? If we wouldn't have tekus in the Gemara, and we wouldn't have chukim in the Torah, we couldn't go further. But that's what the Torah is telling us. Gentlemen, at Khan, next Sunday, I'm showing you how Rabbi Reuben was totally struck out by the B'Samim Rosh. He asked me about shaving. We spoke about shaving. He let the curveball go right by him yesterday. Show you next week. The summer roast was so clever. Wow. Then we're going to go into, I believe, Mara comes next. I'm going to show you contemporary reference to the summer roast of just a few weeks ago. Monday's class next week is $99,000 to walk in, but I'm waiving it because the Rebbe may get hysterical and act like a jerk, and if that's the case, it's worth laughing at the Rebbe. Chinam ein kesef. Now, some of the freebies today, not simple. They put the matmid online, I'm told, and someone... It's amazing.
Wow.
There's Rabbi Lichtenstein as I knew him. And you know what's frightening here? He looks exactly like his son Moshe.
What?
It is frightening. And I can tell you, in my case, I haven't seen my brother in a number of years. My kid brother lives in Las Vegas. So he comes to my shir in Las Vegas Wednesday night. My brother walks in with his wife. I was shaking. The image of my father. Yeah. I got to develop the pictures, have them printed. You remember my father?
Yeah, I remember your father.
His face from the time, exactly the replica of my father. Then my grandson, who's studying psychology now, he finished Dresden, he's already in the University of Psychology. So my grandson tells me on Shabbos, the older we grow, the more we look like our parents.
Yeah.
All I can tell you, this is Rabaran. And you know, this is why they called him the babe. He had a baby face. A kid has a chubby face.
Also,
And, that's the quote. From the mouths of babes, oft times comes genius. Right?
Gems.
Gentlemen, I apologize. I'm not seeing properly. It's very simple. I had one cataract, and the other one is an old Bashel. So I'm in the middle. I don't want to get new glasses because I know the minute I have the second cataract, my eyes are going to shift entirely. And it's worse than you think because the optometrist is my student, and he will not charge me. So he gives me the glasses chinam and kesef. These are expensive glasses. It's Verilux. So I don't want to go bother him for a free, and again, bother him. If I know, I have a doctor's appointment in May. I'll find out if it's so, we can have the second operation.
Rebbe, Rebbe's picture is not the only masochism that was dug up recently.
Oh, there I am. That's it. This a Chabadnik download, and it's the Beit HaLevi. And if you look at him closely, there's a tremendous resemblance to the Rebbe. Take a look.
Someone says the Bubba Sally picture and a. Is this the picture they were
talking
about?
This is the Yitzchak. This appeared on the websites. It is maledicting. Maledicting the swing to the right. So, and if anyone wants the information on tonight's lecture by Rabbi Dr. Moshe Tendler, here it is.
That was great. Every school of YU is
only YU or anybody else?